From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
You plant a tree, you water it, you can watch it grow. That's a powerful thing. If you help people understand or give them opportunities to be productive, they will act accordingly.
Acting accordingly, taking into account the recession, global warming, crazy gas prices, acting accordingly means living la vida verde, living green. And where is it happening? In some of the most unexpected places, like the South Bronx.
Today, we just removed a whole bunch of plastic bottles from the side of this river, from just this little corner here.
Living green, no longer just a trendy hobby for the suburbs. It's now becoming an economic necessity and urban reality. But for many Latinos, it's nothing new. Or so says writer Michelle Cerros.
My family didn't know that our own version of the three R's, redo, regift, and of course, refry, would ever be in such vogue.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. For analysis of the news affecting Latinos this week, we're joined by Maria Elena Salinas, national news anchor for Univision, the Spanish language television news network. Hola, Maria Elena.
Hi, Maria. Nice to talk to you.
So Senator Clinton pulled off a very narrow win in Indiana. And though analysts basically say her chances of winning the popular vote and the delegate count is nearly impossible, she says she is going to stay in the race.
Tonight, we've come from behind. We've broken the tie. And thanks to you, it's full speed onto the White House.
So, Maria Elena, the focus is shifting to the superdelegates. How many are Latinos and what direction are they leaning?
Well, it's hard to give exact numbers, Maria, but it's estimated that there's about 64 Latino delegates. And, you know, in the beginning of the week before the primaries in North Carolina and Indiana, one of the breakdowns showed that Hillary Clinton had 39 of them and Barack Obama had 14, 11 of them were uncommitted. And I guess if we take a look at that, really they reflect what the popular vote is among Latino voters in the latest polls, which is about what, maybe around 60% of Latino voters support Hillary Clinton. Now, one of the things that could shift the balance the other way is, if you recall, Patty Solis Doyle, who used to be her campaign manager, was removed from the campaign. And there's been a little bit of a backlash because some of the superdelegates complained about it. And, you know, there was a message sent out to other superdelegates saying we should not support Hillary for eliminating from the top position of her campaign a Latina. So that might be a backlash that might hurt her with the Hispanic superdelegates. But at this point, there's just not that many left to make that much of a difference.
All right. So let's talk about someplace that I never imagined. Really, Maria Elena, when did you think that you would see the day that Puerto Rico would have a real impact on the U.S. elections with a primary? I mean, this is amazing. I can't imagine what the feeling is in Puerto Rico right now. But what are we looking at in terms of Puerto Rico? And how much do you really think it's going to have an impact?
Politics is probably the favorite pastime of Puerto Ricans besides salsa and baseball. They just love politics. So, you know, to have this opportunity to really weigh in on the nomination process is going to be something really important to them. You know, Hillary does really well there in the polls, and it would not be a surprise if she won there. The latest poll had her 13 points ahead of Obama. And, you know, what happens in Puerto Rico is something similar to what happens in the rest of Latin America, which is very high voter turnout. One, because it's on Sunday, and two, because people are not that apathetic about elections as they are in the continental United States. And people are going to take advantage of this so that they can influence the political campaign. Now, from the primaries that are left, the one in Puerto Rico on June 1st is probably the largest one with 63 delegates. So it could help push Hillary a little bit closer, but it's not going to help her win. But to Puerto Ricans, you know, going to vote is important also because they have a lot of local issues that they want to deal with. And remember that their political status is, you know, is always reason for heated debates and always gets them going and gets them out in the polls.
Well, and Puerto Rico happens to have the largest voter turnout in the entire Western Hemisphere, 98% of the population votes. Let's move on now to what could happen in Florida. There's a lot of talk about Florida, but one thing that is expected is the release of the voter registration figures. For the first time, Maria Elena, the number of Hispanic Democrats in Florida is expected to exceed the number of Hispanic Republicans. Also something that, you know, we thought could happen, but quite surprising still.
The Latino population here, or Latino voters, have made a difference in the past. and they have overwhelmingly voted Republican. Most of them are Cuban Americans, but that is changing. Not only within the Cuban American community, what, you know, the younger generation now is changing its attitude towards politics, but there's also a lot of new Hispanic groups. There's a lot of Puerto Ricans in Orlando, for example. There's a lot of South and Central Americans, even some Mexicans who have become citizens, and they're not necessarily committed to one party or the other. And many of those new citizens have registered as Democrats. So, you know, if it's true that recently naturalized citizens go out and vote in higher numbers because they want to take advantage of this newly acquired right, then that might help the Democrats. So if it's a tight race, really they could make the difference again, like they did 8 years ago.
Okay, well, a lot of people are getting tired of it, but we're still fascinated by electoral politics.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, Maria Elena.
Thank you, Maria. Take care.
Maria Elena Salinas is a syndicated columnist and national news anchor for Univision, the Spanish language television network. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Going green. Not so long ago, it seemed that most Americans were resistant to the notion. But with food and energy prices skyrocketing, the green economy is now seen by many as the key to future growth. So just how do Americans find their place in this new reality? It's not an easy switch, especially for those with the least amount and access to education and little money to buy more expensive, eco-friendly products. But the Sustainable South Bronx, an organization that operates in one of the most disadvantaged neighborhoods in the country, is trying to do just that, train local residents for green-collar jobs and use green opportunities as a path out of poverty. Latino USA's Lily Percy has our story.
Of all the five boroughs in the city of New York, the Bronx is easily the most misrepresented. On film, it has been portrayed as a breeding ground for crime and poverty, a den of gray pavement and hostility where violence serves as a backdrop for the daily lives of most of its residents. Through the years, the South Bronx has been used time and again as the city's landfill of choice. The South Bronx holds 25% of New York City's waste, with power plants and waste facilities lining up streets and avenues like shopping malls. The South Bronx is also home to some of the poorest neighborhoods in the country. In the 70s, it was even on fire. Majora Carter grew up in this environment.
You know, I grew up during the South Bronx era when it was literally burning around me because of financial disinvestment. Landlords torched their own building. I mean, it was the kind of awful place to grow up in that was the subject of nightly news, and it was just, it had the kind of oppressive feel, and you knew it because you were the poster child for urban blight. Nothing in your community was good. And so I spent many years making sure that I left, you know, for college or whatever. And I came back home, you know, got politicized when we discovered just how much our community, which is a poor community of color, primarily Latino and Black American, and how because we were poor, because we have color, that we were used as a repository for all the things that wealthier and usually whiter communities could afford to avoid. And when that hit me, suddenly I looked at my community in a completely different way.
So when Majora Carter read a news article in 2001 stating that Mayor Giuliani and Governor Pataki planned to build yet another waste facility in the South Bronx, she decided to do something about it. Outraged at the proposal, Carter began mobilizing within her community and was able to defeat them. Shortly thereafter, Carter formed Sustainable South Bronx as a way to respond to the environmental changes going on in her home. Today, Sustainable South Bronx offers a variety of programs to teach community members about what they can do to help improve their environment. One such program is BEST, which stands for Bronx Environmental Stewardship Training. The course runs for 10 weeks and teaches the 10 to 15 trainees the basic hands-on skills that they need to aid in riverbank restoration, brownfield restoration, pruning, and green roof installation in and around the South Bronx. Majora Carter explains.
Physically, like you plant a tree You water it. You maintain it. You watch. You can watch it grow. That's a powerful thing to give to somebody and to know that they were directly responsible. People take that in, and I think it translates to all other parts of their lives. If you help people understand or give them opportunities to be productive, they will act accordingly.
It is a beautiful spring morning at Bronx River Park. The river, however, is littered with waste, so trainees in the BEST program have gathered this morning to clean up. Chris Coleman is one of the trainees.
The reason why I'm doing this project, SSB, because I want to try to improve the environment, because I believe the Bronx River is beautiful, you know, here. We don't have to go all the way to the Adirondacks or Saranac Lake or the Catskills or out in Long Island to enjoy, you know, peace and quiet. But I believe that there's a refuge here in our own parks and our own backyard that we can enjoy, that we can explore, that we never heard of or seen before, you know.
Today, we just removed a whole bunch of plastic bottles from the side of this river. It's about 10 bags of garbage from just this little corner here.
Hector Rivera, another South Bronx trainee, says that the community has to take responsibility for their environment.
I think they should have more of it. I think they should have more people out here doing it, because a lot of this stuff is not being taken care of, and they need people to take care of it. It's like, you know, a lot of plastic, a lot of garbage, a lot of debris. It's like unkempt compared to the outer boroughs anyway.
And that's been the goal of Sustainable South Bronx with their slogan, Green for Ghettos. After 4 years of running the training program, they have seen incredible results. 85% of BEST graduates have found employment in various environmental organizations in the area, with 10% going on to pursue college degrees. Many of the trainees in the program are former convicts who, until Sustainable South Bronx, had been unable to find employment due to their past. This was the case for Amilcar Leboy, who now serves as a steward for the training program.
One thing I got to give it to Sustainable South Bronx, that they do not discriminate color, race, your history, because they proved it to me themselves. They knew everything, what I went through. They knew that I was incarcerated. They knew that I was, when I was released while I was incarcerated. And they told me, do not worry. Everybody has a chance. And they proved to me that I had that chance.
The Green Jobs training program that Sustainable South Bronx offers is making a huge difference in the lives of men and women in the program. Not only financially, as the training ultimately provides them with job opportunities that pay far above the standard minimum wages they're accustomed to, but emotionally as well. Green jobs symbolize new beginnings for a community that had long given up on the notion. And this is something that, even after 7 years running the organization, still overwhelms Carter.
Yeah, seeing people's lives change and to know what's out there for them, or what was waiting for them if they'd kept walking in that direction, and to know that all we did was provide a different path. It also makes me sad, because there's so many more out there that we have not touched yet. Like, my only real dream is that we actually have the opportunity to support more, and that what the example that we've shown here is actually taken on as a real viable way to develop our communities and the people that are in it.
For Latina USA, this is Lily Percy.
So just how green is the Latino community becoming? Well, we decided to talk to Nora Vargas. She's executive director of the Latino Issues Forum based in San Francisco. Welcome to Latino USA, Nora.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Nora, so we just heard a report about an organization in New York that's working to create green-collar jobs in low-income communities for Latinos and African Americans. But in your experience, to what extent really is the Latino community embracing the notion of living green and getting greener?
Well, actually, you know, Latino Issues Forum has been working around environmental issues for many years. And what we have found is that Latinos really are environmentally conscious. This is a community of consumers that are, you know, accustomed to recycling jars instead of using unrecyclable containers. You know, these are folks who we walk or we take the bus while we, you know, basically are reducing the carbon footprint, even though we do it, might be doing it for economic reasons, because we are naturally more of an environmentally friendly community. So we are already doing it, although folks may not know that they're doing it for that reason.
I wonder whether or not it might be important to kind of put it out there publicly, just so that it reinforces in the community, like, this is not such a foreign concept. If you reinforced it to a community, they might even be more open to it.
We actually right now are working on a statewide initiative to really engage Latino communities around the sort of greening initiative that it's not just about the environment and jobs, but it's also about education and about our kids having access to these technology careers that are going to be out there, and so that they can be part of this new generation who's really not only putting the solar panels on, but also designing the solar panels in our community. So I think that part of what we haven't done and that we're working on is really building those coalitions, bringing people together so that we can let them know about the work that's being done.
Okay, so one of the things, for example, my husband, also in an effort to go green in our home, went and changed all of our light bulbs, which is great. And I noticed the change and I feel great about it. But that meant a lot of upfront money. What about people who don't have that kind of upfront money to buy what it takes to go green?
Well, one of the things that we are doing here in San Francisco, for instance, is really targeted like the Mission District and some of the, you know, local areas where there's a high propensity of Latinos living, where they're actually getting light bulbs and they're getting the information on how to conserve energy. So energy efficiency is like at the core of everything we do, because it's important for people to know that they can go somewhere and get a light bulb, and then they will immediately notice the difference in their bills as soon as that happens.
So when you think about the South Bronx, I mean, the reality is that many years ago, and for many years, there was a lot of garbage dumps in the community, a lot of power plants. You know, many Latino and African American communities are still like that. So how do communities that, you know, really feel left out, feel invisible, don't have access, how do they really go about starting to create change on environmental issues?
Well, I think in California in particular right now, with the energy issues that we're dealing with, you'll see it in areas like in Chula Vista, the Central Valley, and even San Francisco, where this concept of the peaker plants and you know, the emission that is polluting our communities, a lot of communities are really rallying together because they know that this is not good for their kids and for the area. And so they're beginning to be actively involved with their local city councils and their state government so that folks understand that this is something that they can actually put a stop to, and that we need to make sure that our communities are not only safe, but that they're also healthy.
So what about your organization? What is it that you guys kind of hope to do with the work that you, you know, want to do with bringing La Vida Verde to Latinos?
Well, LIF is a statewide organization, but as you know, California, anything that happens in California usually has an impact across the nation. And because we have been at the forefront with environmental and energy issues, I think that there's a lot of information not only on our website, lif.org, but the coalitions that we're creating across the state, that specifically with curriculum around clean energy and energy efficiency training programs, so that the programs will be in our high schools, technical schools, colleges and universities. And that's what, that way we really are sort of creating this new generation of workers that are pursuing careers in the clean energy field as well. So there's a lot of different opportunities for us to really get involved. And what's really interesting is that Latinos actually do care about global warming, and they do care about, you know, what is really happening. Because for us, when you're talking about air quality, you're talking about issues of asthma and respiratory problems in a lot of our community. So there's a direct link and connection to those issues.
Well, thanks for the work you do, Nora.
Thank you very much.
Nora Vargas is the executive director of the Latino Issues Forum based in San Francisco. So just how green are you? We want to hear your comments about the topic and others that you hear on Latino USA. So call our listener comment line. It's 800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. In a minute, El Sabor Verde, a new book on how to cook green and healthy in my neck of the woods, Spanish Harlem, coming up on Latino USA, no se vayan. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The next time you go to the grocery store, you might want to ask yourself, just how far away did that tomato or apple have to travel to get to you? On average, a store's produce travels 1,500 miles to get to the consumer. So for many experts, going green also means buying your food locally. Of course, for many of us, there isn't a local farmer's market. That's the situation that Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer found in his neighborhood, which is Spanish Harlem. So he decided to create a cookbook for his community that promoted locally available products while educating residents about the health and environmental impacts of their food. The result is the Go Green East Harlem Cookbook. And we're pleased to have Scott Stringer with us here on the show. Welcome to Latino USA, neighbor. So where did this idea come from? You live in the neighborhood and you just thought, you know, I really want to help my fellow residents get healthy, get access to healthier food? Or, you know, was it a kind of midnight, I'm eating Haagen-Dazs and I really should be eating something healthier kind of situation?
You know, as a born and bred New Yorker who actually grew up in northern Manhattan in Washington Heights and now is borough president representing all the people on this wonderful island, it was very clear to me very early on that while the borough is strong and vibrant economically, there are parts of this wonderful island that where people are really suffering. So we decided to create an initiative in my office called the Go Green East Harlem Initiative, which has now involved hundreds of people from the community, not only creating the cookbook, but working on real environmental issues to reduce asthma, obesity, and diabetes in the community by 2010.
So you go around, you decide that one of the things you want to do is this cookbook, which is free to residents in the neighborhood. And you did it in a way which I love, because you went to local restaurants and community members and asked them for their healthiest recipes. So your favorite recipe of all from the book would be?
The one that has the most mojo in the book is Potatolicious. There's a wonderful salmon dish in the book. There's, you know, a whole host of salads, and the collaboration with the community was really getting restaurant owners and community people to submit the recipes. We had the Integrative Nutrition School vet them so we knew that they were healthy. And then we had these wonderful kids from the International Center of Photography volunteer their time, come to East Harlem this past summer, and take these wonderful portraits of the neighborhood. So it's not just a bilingual healthy cookbook. It really is a love story about East Harlem.
One of the things that people don't know is that East Harlem, for example, used to be the home of Italian immigrants. Then it was the home of Puerto Rican immigrants or Puerto Rican residents who had come from the island. Now it's a hub for Mexicanos. And you've captured in the book, you know, Rao's, many people might know, is the most difficult restaurant in the world to get into. You know, Madonna's got her own seat there permanently. It's a little tiny Italian restaurant. They gave you a recipe. And then you have recipes from the Puerto Rican residents and Mexican residents, right?
Absolutely. We have recipes from Rao's, where I can't get a reservation, to Ricardo's, which is come one, come all. We have restaurants for Creole food. We have that's the beauty about East Harlem. You're absolutely right. You have Dominican restaurants, Puerto Rican restaurants, Italian restaurants, African restaurants. It's unbelievable. And as the book gains more cachet and people start realizing what this Go Green initiative was all about, we now have people coming up to Harlem for the first time, going to the Harlem Tea Room or going to different restaurants in the neighborhood. It's really incredible. And it's not our initiative. People said, well, Borough President, you wrote a cookbook. I tell the people, I was the coordinator. The people in the neighborhood truly wrote this cookbook.
So, Scott, if you had to choose from your book, the one where you're like, okay, it's Sunday and I'm going to cook, which is your favorite recipe? What do you like to take off the book? Come on, give us your secrets here.
If I gave that to you and you told people all over the country, I'd be a marked man.
You'd have a lot of enemies in East Harlem.
You'd think I want to go through East Harlem with having spilled the beans to you? No way. And you live in the community.
That's right. East Harlem's a kind of tough place.
You know, unless you live the New York experience and you realize that all the languages that are spoken here and how people walk and the swagger and the attitude, you just can't fully understand the cookbook and you can't understand what goes on in this place. But it's really magnificent.
Scott Stringer, thank you so much for bringing together great recipes and great restaurants and great community leaders from East Harlem. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Scott M. Stringer is Manhattan Borough President and editor of the Go Green Cookbook, published by Jones Books.
I emerge daily by radio ads, TV commercials, and Madonna to live green, and I can't help but roll my eyes. I mean, growing up in a working-class Mexican-American family, I've been living la vida verde, living green, all my life.
Writer Michelle Cerros.
Do you really want to know about an inconvenient truth? The truth is, what is now considered a trendy approach to sustainable living was once considered an embarrassing lifestyle. For instance, when I was in the sixth grade, I had invited popular girl Terry Fitzsimmons to my house for the first time. Upon seeing my mother clean her hallway mirror with vinegar water and newspaper, she promptly questioned, "Why doesn't she just use Windex?" in a tone that implied we were too poor to afford the luxurious blue-tinted liquid, and that she would definitely tell everyone Monday at school. If that wasn't bad enough, just getting to school was an ordeal. Riding the bus may be a political statement for some, but for me, it was downright humiliating. Our city's bus line was SCAT, an acronym for South Coast Area Transit. But it was often called by the kids who had parents who owned two cars, electric or not, that SCAT actually stood for Showing Chicanos Around Town. Because at the time, the majority of riders were Chicano. Couldn't anyone realize that we were just trying to reduce our carbon footprints by resting them on the seat in front of us? But in actuality, not all pre-green memories make me red in embarrassment. I remember my grandmother often walked over to our house just to visit and share extra food she happened to have in the fridge. And Grandpa Rudy's naturally free-for-all garden was quite the permacultural Eden. Range-free chickens roamed about, contributing organic fertilizer that produced an unbelievable crop of corn that would make even Whole Foods, excuse the pun, green with envy. Yes, back in the day, my family didn't know that our own version of the three R's, redo, regift, and of course, refry, would ever be in such vogue. We were truly OG, originally green, before our time. But to us, it was just basically living smart, living Latino. And that was nothing new.
Michelle Cerros is an author based in Southern California. Latino USA was produced this week by Walter Morgan, Benjamin Jacob, Angela Maldonado, and Alex Avila. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. To listen to our podcasts, go to latinousa.org or look for us on iTunes. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. The Gruber Family Foundation, for support of NPR's international coverage. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring. Catalog at 1-800-FLOORING. This is NPR, National Public Radio.